This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Things were mostly good for Ana Nunez growing up in Cuba. She loved school and the close-knit neighborhood where her family lived. But there were hardships as well. There were periodic food and electricity shortages. In fact, she didn't even see a grocery store or even an apple until she was 9 years old. She and the rest of her family followed her father to the U.S. after he defected. Ana didn't know any English when she got here, and for the first time in her life, she struggled with school. But she stuck with it and eventually went on to college and then law school. Today, she's a partner at the Raleigh law firm of Fay and Grafton. She practices criminal and immigration law. She says the resilience she developed as a girl in Cuba is an important tool for her success today. Ana Nunez, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Frank. Good to be here.
You grew up in Cuba in the late 80s, early 90s?
Right? Yes. So I was born in 85. So I grew up in Cuba late 80s, early 90s, which I think was an interesting period in Cuban history due to Russia falling in the late 80s. So Cuba suffered a lot during that specific time period because of the resources that were coming from Russia were no longer available to our country. So it was an interesting time.
Right. But for you, it's kind of it was all you knew, right?
Yes. So we there's a name for it in history. It's called the special period. But that's all, I just knew it as growing up, which was a period of scarcity in Cuba. There wasn't a lot because of Russia falling. So there was no gasoline. There was no dairy cows. Cubans went on a soy-based diet. That's not known, but there was a lot of soy yogurt, soybean products and all that. And that was just how I grew up because that's all I knew.
And before that, I mean, things were sparse, but not so scarce. I mean, the under the communist regime, especially with American sanctions and Western sanctions, there had to be a fair amount of ingenuity to get by before that.
Yes, there was. I think, and I couldn't speak before I was born, but certainly the years following the revolution and the war, there was scarcity. There was lack of resources. There was an embargo, as you know, so there's nothing coming in. So Cuba relied on other countries like Russia, and when that didn't go well, it really came into a very dark period where there were no resources.
And what was it like for you growing up, though?
So I like to tell folks I had a very happy childhood. I had a great childhood. I loved my school. Cuba has a very rigorous education program for children, but it's one where you don't have homework after school, so everybody just goes home and has fun. And I had neighborhood friends. Everybody played outside together till the lights, came on. And so I had a very good childhood. I think the issues that we had while I was growing up weren't something I noticed. I think my parents obviously noticed a lot more. But I would remember just sitting. We had this great big red chair. It was like a leather big chair.
Yeah.
And I remember sitting there at night just sweating, dripping in sweat because it was so hot and there was no electricity. And I would be like, well, can we turn a fan on? Can we do anything? And there would be nothing we could do because there was no electricity.
Right.
So you would notice that from time to time, the lack of food, the lack of our ability to have water sometimes, that became an issue. And it wasn't just us, all of Cuba was suffering in those ways at that time.
Both of your parents were doctors?
Yes. Yes.
What was that like for them? And what was that like for you? Because community health was, health care is a lot different.
Yes. Obviously. So it's different in the sense my dad did something called nuclear medicine, which is, if I understand it correctly, it's how, your body reacts to radiation and all that. And my mom is a psychiatrist, so it's very different. So I would spend a lot of my summers with my mom in the hospital she worked at. And it was very common for me to show up there. And she worked in a psych ward, in a psychiatric unit. But it was normal for me to go up there and play soccer with the patients and just kind of run around and cause havoc with the nurses. But that's how I spent my summer. And I think for my parents, they found a way to survive, like a lot of other people with families. You know, they found a way to make it through professionally, also getting the basic necessities that we needed, food. You know, there was a lot of bartering, I think, at that point. Anything like gasoline, for example, we had cars at different points. I think we had a Russian car. And then we also had a Volkswagen Beetle. My dad had a like a 1960 something Volkswagen Beetle that was torn up inside because he had it for so long.
Yeah.
But, you know, there was no gas to drive. Public transportation was horrible. So those things, I think, as adults, they just took upon themselves to deal with and try to work through. And I think professionally for them, it must have been very frustrating because they couldn't, you know, their work wasn't appreciated as some professional work is appreciated here in the United States. They were restricted in their travel. They couldn't go to conferences that they wanted to go to. They couldn't maybe talk about the ideas or theories they wanted to talk about at that time. So I think professionally, it must have been difficult for them at that time.
So much so that your father eventually defected, right?
Yes, yes.
Well, talk to us about that.
Well, as far as I know, he defected. My understanding was in 91 or 92. And he first, I believe, went to Canada and then came to the United States. He had his brother already here and his mother already here. We followed him 3 years later. But during that time in Cuba, it was very difficult without my father. We moved around some.
Was there much persecution now that your father had left under those circumstances?
We didn't experience persecution per se, but there was a lot of change. You know, there was moving to a smaller place, going to a different school. We were, I don't want to say in hiding, but we certainly were not as visible to my friends and other family members. So it was just a different way of life.
Much of this, I suppose, the loss of income would account for
yes,
some of that.
Yeah, the loss of income. Also, when my father came here, you know, he had a medical degree from another country, which doesn't, you don't get it here. You have to go through the whole training again as a doctor. So, there was a lot of difficulty in my dad just getting his medical degree back, and that took a lot of years. And then my mom also got hers back when she came here,
now,
but that took a long time.
When I asked you about your father's defection, you said, well, as far as I know, what were they telling you at the time? You weren't getting the whole story.
So
right?
No, they told me my father went on vacation, and then sometime later
they told
me what happened.
So we haven't even gotten a postcard.
Yeah, but, you know, it's one of those things is I think – my parents did the right thing. You know, as a child, you don't really understand. And eventually I learned what happened and what was going on. And, you know, I think I'm very thankful that my parents chose to come here because, I mean, my life is a whole new life that I have now that I don't know what it would have been like if I stayed in Cuba, but certainly it's different now. But yeah, so they just told me that he was going on vacation. And he had gone, so in, I think, 89, he had gone to Chernobyl to help with the radioactive issues there. So he had traveled before. He had gone to Russia. He had gone to Bulgaria. He'd gone to a couple of places. So it was certainly a little bit different. And then when he didn't come back after a month or so, I was like, hey, where's Dad? And then my mom, you know, sat me down and told me.
Eventually, you all followed. Talk about when did that happen and what was that like?
So we came in, it was June 1st of 1994. The reason I remember that is my sister's birthday is on the 12th of June. So we rode on this propeller plane. It was supposed to be a very quick flight. A flight from Havana to Miami is about 30 minutes now. For some reason, it lasts about 90 minutes back then. The plane was like taking a bus ride. It was just bumpy the whole entire time. My sister just vomited all over the airplane. It was horrible.
Yeah. But you just hope from Havana to Miami, it's an express. But, I'll keep going.
So we got here, and I had never seen an airport like that, or Havana airport is tiny. And the first thing I noticed, we saw an escalator. And I had never seen an escalator before. And we, this, I'm still deathly afraid of escalators. But my mom was like, just, you know, get on it. Everything's fine. And then right before I get on it, this lady who was in our same flight fell and kind of, I guess, cut herself on her calf. And I was like, I'm not getting on that thing. So they had to basically pull me into it. But that was my first experience with an escalator.
Did your mom tell you? I mean, did you know that you were leaving, and did you have permission at that point, or were you in effect defecting as well?
So we had essentially, my dad had asked for us as his derivatives, so as his family members. So we did have permission to come here. And in the United States, there's something called the Cuban Adjustment Act. So if you're admitted or paroled into the United States, we were admitted at that time. After 1 year and one day, you can apply for your green card or your residency. So we came in, and it was fairly quick that we received legal status, but the airport was quite an experience.
No, it sounds that way. There are many experiences that followed, and we'll hear some of them when I continue my conversation with Anna Nunez, who's a partner at the Raleigh law firm of Fay and Grafton, specializes in immigration law. Our conversation will continue on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Anna Nunez has fond memories of her childhood in Cuba, even though there were food and electricity shortages. Her father defected to the U.S. in the early 90s, and a couple of years later, she and the rest of her family followed. Anna didn't speak any English and struggled with school, but eventually went to law school, and now she's a partner at Fay and Grafton in Raleigh. So we got you somehow up and down the stairs at Miami Airport, but you were not about to take the escalator.
That's right.
What else about that airport? I mean, this is it. You're here, and this must have looked very different to you, even at the airport.
Yeah. So, you know, for anybody who comes to the United States for the first time, I think most folks are in awe. I was in complete awe. I had never seen, you know, TVs like that. I had never seen, you know, such a big place before. Even the waiting, so the gates, you know, where you wait for your flight, I was just enamored by everything. I had never seen so many airplanes. It was my first time on an airplane, so it was insane. And when you get out of the airport, you know, anytime you leave Miami Airport, which is a pretty busy international airport, there's a rush of cars, you know, everywhere. And when we got in my father's car, I had immediately thought that this was the nicest car I had ever been in. It was like, it was a 91 Ford Escort. It was white. We kept it for a very long time, and I love that car.
It was not a Volkswagen Beetle.
No, it was interior, no gas. Yeah, it was one of those Ford Escorts that when you close the door, the seatbelt just automatically comes up, you know.
Okay, so there's the upside in this sort of dazzling new spectacle now that you find yourself in. But now the reality hits. You've got to go to school.
Yes.
Right? Talk about that.
So so I was in summer when I got here. So the first thing my parents did that was very smart is that they put me in these community English classes. And I had no knowledge of English. My father spoke English. My mother did not. So I went to these English classes to try to just pick up some basic things before school started. And the funny thing about it is that I don't remember learning a damn thing in that class. And it really took me to go to school to learn how to speak English. One of the things that I think I'm very appreciative for is I went to a public school. I went to Coral Gables Elementary. And my teacher would speak English to me and would not let anyone speak Spanish to me. And it was very frustrating for about 3 months because I had no idea what she was saying. But eventually I caught on, and all the kids in Miami speak Spanish. I mean, it's just everybody speaks Spanish there. So they would communicate with me in Spanish outside of school. And slowly but surely, by watching a lot of Power Rangers and Rugrats and The Lion King and all those, you know, great TV features, I learned to speak English. Probably in about 6 months, I could I could get away with most conversations.
What about your mom now? You talked about her not speaking English. I'm trying to think about the experience. In fact, you talk about her going to a grocery store for the first time.
So one of the first things we did was go to Publix, which we have here now, but we still have in Miami. So Publix, I had never seen so much food in my life. It was just abundance of everything. We talked about the apples. I had never seen apples before. I had never tasted an apple. So that was, I got all kinds of apples, ice cream. I mean, we spent so much money. It was $300 and some. I still remember it was back then, which was probably a lot of money. And it was just a different experience. And I found my mom just saving everything, which she still does. You know, my mom washes Ziploc bags and reuses them, washes paper towels and reuses them.
Whoa. Well, I have to see that.
Yeah. So, but that's just a cultural thing. You know, we don't really like to waste anything.
Right.
And that became almost, funny at times, but thinking back on it, that was very powerful for them to have all these things that people just throw out,
sure.
For no reason, and things that we could reuse.
Yeah,
No,
and it. I don't know about the paper towels, but certainly the plastic bags. Trying to imagine that. And now talk about your experience in school. You said, the first 3 to 6 months anyway, pretty frustrating and difficult for you. So what was going through your head before the Power Rangers took hold?
Yeah, well, one of the things that as a kid, when you're in that position, you're really trying to fit in because you're in a new environment, new school, people you don't know. Like a lot of those other children, I didn't have any friends because I was new. So a lot of it was just trying to fit in with the other kids and trying to figure out, what's going on here. But thankfully, kids all like the same thing. So, I made friends quickly, but it was frustrating because in Cuba, I was already in the fourth grade and I didn't get to finish. So I had to essentially repeat all of fourth grade over. I was a year ahead and now I was a year behind essentially. I didn't understand anything. The way math was taught was different. The way teachers engaged students was different. It was a lot more, I don't want to say rigorous, but it was certainly a lot more regimented than what I was used to. In Cuba, you had a lot of freedom as a student, even a young student. So those things were a little bit different. But I'm so thankful. I had such a great teacher in the fourth grade that made a huge difference because she really embraced me in her classroom and, made my learning experience one that really was fruitful. I got a lot out of it.
Did you feel that at the time? Because I would think that at least for a moment, you did pretty well in school up until then,
yes.
In Cuba. So I wonder if it has any sense, changed your own self-impression, your own sense of self-esteem.
And the thing is, when you're a good student at some point and then you're no longer a good student is a weird, it's a weird dynamic. And I developed a dislike of school at that point, which I held on to for many years.
But eventually it came out of it. Talk about the change in your decision then to go to college and the pursuit that you or the,
sure.
the studies that you pursued.
So I went to a private high school and then, I had to make a decision about college. Obviously, my parents, both doctors, expected my sister and I to go to college. But college here is very different than college in Cuba. First of all, college in Cuba is free. Here you got to pay for everything. Mm-hmm. So one of those things was economically, what was that going to look like? And what was I going to study? And, so I went to school for social work. I actually have a social work degree and a psychology degree. And after I went to school for social work, I got my master's in social work. And I started working in Washington, D.C. for a couple of years for a nonprofit there that worked with the government. And eventually, I really got frustrated with all these policies and laws. And I worked with women that were HIV positive and providing services for their families. And at that time, I just decided, I need to go to law school to understand all this because this is just crazy. So I actually went to law school with wanting to do one thing, and I ended up coming out doing something. Was it mostly different?
Were you thinking about a law degree to help, in this case, women navigate whatever systems they had available for HIV treatment?
I wanted to learn more about healthcare law and the policy that kind of went behind all these laws that were in place, and specifically in the cities, you know, and funding, and trying to figure all these big issues out. And a lot of it, you know, I talked to a couple of senators who were like, hey, why don't you go to law school? And I did. I went to law school here at NCCU and North Carolina Central University.
Well, talk about that decision. Why did you decide to go to Central?
So the funny thing is, one of my colleagues was a Central grad. And she was like, you got to check it out. You've got to check out Central. So I actually drove from D.C. to Durham to check it out. And I just fell in love with the school. And I'm so glad that I went there. It was an amazing experience. I have some of the best colleagues, classmates, friends.
What made it an amazing experience?
I think Central's mission of really providing lawyers for the community, and lawyers that know how to be lawyers and know how to do things. So knowing how to handle yourself in court, giving students incredible clinical experiences, clerkships, those things were important to me. I myself had a great experience at Central. I did a lot of hands-on legal work, and that made the difference. I think I was very practice ready when I left law school.
And you chose, at that point, you were interested in becoming a criminal lawyer, right?
Yeah. So my second and third year of law school, I worked at the public defender's office as a law student in Wake County. And as soon as I got there, I was like, this is what I want to do. This place is awesome. The lawyers are awesome. The clients are great. And I basically clerked there for a couple of years. Upon graduation, I was unsure if I wanted to take the North Carolina bar or the Florida bar. I ended up taking the North Carolina bar, and I was offered a job there, and I loved it. I was there for about, I want to say, 7-8 months, and then I moved on to private practice.
But you did an internship with the North Carolina Innocence Inquiry Commission that
Yes.
affected you as well.
Yeah, so I did that, I believe it was a spring semester. It was really interesting work in that I had never seen, you know, I went into that internship thinking that it was going to be something, and it was something completely different.
Well, what did you think it was going to be?
I thought it was going to be partially maybe what it was. A lot of folks writing in asking for the commission to look into their case. But what I didn't realize is the work that goes behind, you know, those letters. You know, the staff at the commission at that time had, you know, an incredible caseload, and they would do these incredible, thorough investigations. The scientific knowledge, I think one of the lawyers had to do them because there was a lot of DNA issues.
We should probably pause here and describe what that was
Sure.
and how unique it was
Yes.
In this nation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that to me, it was just so different to see, because we never get to see, or at least I had never gotten to experience that background work. So as interns, what we would do is just catalog everything, sometimes go to interviews.
But the commission itself, this was a commission that actually, so you can appeal a case, right? We know that anybody can make an appeal. Let's say
Yes.
you were convicted of a crime, you can appeal. But all that means is that somebody's going to look at the process you went through and make sure that you got a fair trial. Whether or not there were mitigating circumstances or there might have been other evidence to suggest your actual innocence
Yes.
is never part of a legal appeal in most cases. This was categorically different. If you could show that something did or did not happen during that trial that would have shown exonerated you, you get to re-look at that, re-examine the trial. And this is unique in the United States at
Yes.
the moment, right?
Yeah. And I was so impressed that they would do this kind of work with so little staff. And, you know, these lawyers and investigators would go out and speak to witnesses. They would speak to defendants who were appealing their case. So it was really really good work, and I really enjoyed that summer as well, or that spring.
Well, and talk about that, because I think you were clerking for a Superior Court judge who was a former public defender
yes.
in Wayne County. Too,
yeah,
right?
So Brian Collins, I was clerking for him, just also an amazing, amazing now judge, great teacher, great listener for a law student. You know, I asked a ton of questions. He always answered all of my questions. He taught me a lot. I consider him a great mentor.
Then you worked as an assistant public defender in Wake County.
Yes,
right?
sir.
You talked
mm-hmm.
about that. What did you learn doing that?
So as a public defender, you get slapped with reality every now and again. Mm-hmm. You know, as a law student, you have a lot of illusions of what the justice system looks like or the criminal justice system looks like. And, you know, I was faced with the reality of the issues we have in our communities with poverty, with the racism, with mistrust or distrust of police and law enforcement, and how all that substance abuse and how all these issues just show up in the courtroom every day. And it was interesting, you know, sometimes you would play social worker, sometimes you would play mom. When all you're trying to do is play attorney, but you know, all these other roles come into place. So I think that was one of the greatest lessons I learned, that, you know, as a lawyer in criminal court, when you're representing indigent defendants, you have to understand that they have other issues going on. This isn't their, you know, number one. Sometimes it is their number one priority, but sometimes it's not. And it's your job to stop and listen and figure out where they're at and try to help them the best way that you can.
When those indigent defendants were also immigrants, did you find that your background either helped or didn't help, played any role?
When I started in the public defender's office, I didn't know anything about immigration law. I knew very little, and those issues came up. And a lot of times we would, you know, try to find the answer through an immigration attorney. We would ask the client to go speak to somebody. But those issues kept coming up and kept coming up and kept coming up. Because I spoke Spanish, a lot of Spanish-speaking clients would come to me. But sometimes, you know, if we had clients with immigration issues that did not speak Spanish, they would go to other attorneys. And we would try to figure out the best solutions for them. But at times, you know, our hands were tied because of our job. So we would look for somebody with the knowledge and expertise to help us.
You are focusing now on immigration. That is something that has become more central to your work. When did that change, or how did that change for you?
So I want to say it was the summer of 2015. I was approached by a criminal defense attorney that was a colleague at the courthouse, William Fay, and he asked me to come join their firm, and him and his law partner, Rebecca Grafton. Rebecca was an ex-ICE prosecutor that was moving from Boston to, or that had moved from Boston to North Carolina, and they needed an associate basically to just help them, you know, with the workload. So that's how I got into it. I said, sure, that sounds like a challenge. And I've been there ever since. I'm now a partner. It has been some of the most frustrating and rewarding work I've ever done. It certainly has its rewards, but it has its very, very tough, tough days.
Well, let's start with the bad news. Talk about those hard days. What happens then?
Well, you know, in our line of work, I think anyone that practices immigration law, you know, whenever you lose a case, your client may be deported or may be removed from the United States. And that is not only a huge issue for your client, but their family and, you know, their children. And a lot of times that's hard as an attorney to say, okay, well, you know, we fought all this way, but we're just not going to get the result that we want. So, you know, I talk to a lot of folks about self-care. That's something that comes up a lot in immigration law, because we have tough days, you know, and unfortunately we're having much more tougher days than we have in the past. And, you know, we have days where we win cases for folks that have been here a long time. And those days you really hold on to get you through.
You volunteered at the detention center in Dilley, Texas, right?
Yes, yes. So I did that. I want to say maybe it was 2017, 2016. So if anybody's ever been, Dilley, Texas is a small town in southeastern Texas or southwestern Texas. There's nothing there. There's like one restaurant, two gas stations, and a Days Inn. And there's two detention centers in Dilley. There's a male detention center, and then there's a what we call a family detention center, which is a place where women and children are housed. So I volunteered there for a week. There's a project called the CARA Pro Bono Project, and that project is basically manned so attorneys and staff can go a week at a time to prep these women for credible fear interviews or to help them with asking a judge for bond and those kind of things. So I told Rebecca and Will that I wanted to go for a week. After attending the Federal Bar Conference, all the professors decided it would be a good idea. So I went.
We'll find out what happened when you went when my conversation with Anna Nunez continues. A partner at the Raleigh law firm of Fay and Grafton, grew up in Cuba, came to the U.S. when she was 9. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking with Anna Nunez today, a partner at Raleigh's law firm, Fay and Grafton. Grew up in Cuba, came to the U.S. when she was 9. Says growing up in a communist country, for her, created resilience that helps her even today. And we talked about, you know, becoming first an associate, now a partner at Fay and Grafton in Raleigh, and looking at immigration cases. I know you only spent a week in Dilley, Texas, but it's a fairly infamous center. I mean, this is a privately owned center, and there's been a lot of news about that place.
Yes. Yeah, so the Department of Homeland Security has a contract with this company. So I think one of the issues that folks have is these prison companies rebrand themselves. I don't know if anybody's seen Orange is the New Black, but they certainly like change their name and do all these things to make people think it's another company. But so essentially they're contractors. And when you go into this place, when you look at it from the outside, it says, you know, this is a family detention center. But what really it is a prison. You know, folks are not free to leave, obviously. And Dilley specifically has beds for women and their children. Okay. So it's an interesting place. It's also a place that makes you feel very angry about the state of our country, where we do that to women and children, that we essentially put them in a prison.
Well, look, the argument is, here's the thing, that we have these rules about how you can be in this country and cross these borders. And those rules appear to have been broken. The documentation is not there. What do we do? So how should that be different?
You know, I think detention is not the answer. I think there's a lot of ways to handle this issue. Certainly with the growth in technology that we're having, I think increased border security in the sense of using technology to secure borders instead of a wall, maybe better use of our funds. And certainly putting people in prison, one, I don't think it is economic. It's going to cost us money. And two, you know, you can give them a notice to appear and say, look, have fun, go to immigration court. Now, folks are going to say, well, what if they don't show up? You know, what happens? Well, then they have a judge will order them removed from the United States, and then they'll have an order of removal. But detaining women and children is not the answer. Anybody is not the answer, excuse me.
Well, what were some of the cases that you worked on and some of the stories that you were hearing from the women you talked to?
I can't speak specifically about it, but general stories, there's, you know, folks fleeing civil wars, domestic violence, folks fleeing extortion from gangs. Most of these folks, at least the ones I encountered, came from El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala. And those countries, specifically El Salvador and Honduras, there's a lot of unrest, civil unrest, a lot of gang activity. So certainly that's becoming a big issue for the citizens of those countries. And it's not easy for somebody to say, okay, I'm going to pick up all of my things, I want to bring my kids, and I'm going to get out of here and I'm just going to run. You know, that is not an easy decision. And I think some folks lose sight of that, that somebody made that decision and said, okay, I'm going to die here. I need to leave. And that's difficult for anybody to do. You know, I was very privileged in how I came into the United States. I had an opportunity to travel here and come here legally, like a lot of folks do not have. You know, it's very hard for somebody from Mexico to get a visitor's visa to the United States, or somebody from El Salvador or Honduras. You know, it's theoretically, you know, under the visa waiver program, much easier for folks that are a part of that program to just come in and visit. You know, folks from Canada can come in and visit, you know. So there's a lot of restrictions placed on folks. Right.
And there are no benefits. If you don't have proper documentation, there are no benefits that you can receive in terms of, I think there's this feeling that somehow our public assistance program, however meager and paltry it is, what little there is left of it, somehow goes to people without documentation. It really can't. Not even the Social Security that sometimes gets taken out of your check will never come back to you.
Yeah, and I think that's just one of those misconceptions that folks are like, well, they're taking our jobs and they're taking our, you know, they're using our public benefits. And the bottom line is that, one, they're not eligible for those public benefits. And two, they are not taking your jobs. And again, it's very difficult for somebody who comes here without anything to obtain legal status. There's a difference in the way that you enter and how easy or difficult it is to essentially gain some sort of lawful status here in the U.S. Okay, so if you enter without inspection, it is much harder than if you enter admitted or paroled, which is the way most folks come in when they come in through an airport.
What is your experience as an immigrant, or do you talk about this at all in dealing with your clients? Does it have any effect on that relationship?
I don't talk about my personal experience, but certainly it helps me understand their experience more, and it helps me know where they're coming from. Because when somebody comes into your office and tells you their story, you may be the first person they encounter, you may be the fourth person they encounter, or the tenth person they encounter, but certainly when somebody has the courage to come into your office and tell you what happened to them, and explain themselves and talk about their kids and talk about their, you know, life, that's something that somebody's entrusting you with, you know? And I think keeping that in my mind is helpful, because it helps clients to understand that I may not understand fully their situation, but I certainly empathize with them. And I try to do the best job that I can to help them, because I know to some extent what that feels like.
Do you find yourself working with clients after the fact? I mean, it's one thing to help them gain status or remain here, whatever the case might be. But the resettlement process for people who are here can be difficult. Your escalator escapade is just only one of the many ways in which resettlement can be very difficult and challenging, right?
Yeah. We don't do a lot of resettlement work, but we do speak to clients about some things that are different in America, you know. And culturally, there's a lot of different things in America, you know, but I think it's important to know, one, what your client's background is and understand what their culture is, before you try to kind of explain to them what this is going to be like from now on, you know. But generally, America is very different than what a lot of us are used to back home.
Right. And you've come to this country. Now you are married.
Yes.
And your wife is living here. You're living together with your wife here in North Carolina. You are a lesbian. You're living in North Carolina and the United States now. What would that have been like for you in Cuba?
You know, I don't know. I think gay rights in Cuba, specifically right now, has become a huge issue. I think Cuba is certainly leaning to the progressive side. And I think there's even some law in place, or they're trying to vote on marriage equality right now, but I'm not sure. But I don't know what it would have been like. I hope not bad.
What about when did you first realize this about yourself?
Oh, very young. I don't know. I've just always known in my mind. I couldn't tell you what age, but certainly from a very young age.
You knew
age.
It for yeah. a long time. Your wife is American.
Yes, she's very American. She's from Jersey.
Oh, that kind of an American.
Yes.
Well, so now what about the cultural differences? I mean, between a North Carolinian yeah. and somebody from New Jersey, there'd be plenty of cultural differences, but
All
now
right.
we're talking about Cuba.
So this is going to be the best story you've ever heard, Frank.
Okay.
So we got married in Durham, and our families came in. So my family came in from Miami, and her family came in from Jersey. And Andrea is biracial, so her father's African-American and her mom is white. So we have this brood of people in the house, you know, a bunch of Cubans. And my neighbor in Cuba, which we call my aunt because she's basically part of a family, she came in from England for the wedding. So she takes a shower. We're all at the house, so her parents are staying in my house. My mom is staying in my house. My aunt's staying in my house. She comes in, takes a shower, and puts her underwear in the guest bathroom. Now you can imagine, this is older woman, and she just leaves the underwear there hanging to dry, which is very common in our culture to do that. And we laughed because, you know, guests came in all throughout the day. It was a couple of days before the wedding, and everybody was like, somebody left their underwear in the guest bathroom. And my aunt's like, it's drying. Leave it alone. And it was just one of those things that, yeah. like, my family's like, what's the problem?
Yeah.
And we all had a big laugh about it.
Yeah.
And it stayed there pretty much
every
day.
Time. Yeah. Well, it was until
the wedding.
Right? Because you don't need it until then.
Yeah, that's it was right. pretty hilarious.
And other differences, too, I suppose, just the way you talk to each other.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're my parents are very involved in our life now, So for Cuban parents, you're always their child, no matter how old you are. Yeah. So they, you know, they call you 5 times a day. If you don't pick up the phone, you know, they threaten to call 911. Those kind of things when you're an adult and you're like, I'm at work. I'll call you later.
Well, it's true in America too. It's just because the kids can't find meaningful work.
That's
so they're
right.
still at home. wait, let's do the comparison now, because it seems to me this is fascinating. I mean, in
yeah.
terms of some of the more poignant issues now that we're coping with in the United States, rights issues and
yes.
human rights issues, the way we treat immigrants, the way mm-hmm. we view multiculturalism, gay rights in America, it is trouble for progressives who are seeing this trend. That's troubling for others. You know, it's great news that we're finally taking America back again. So that's the struggle here.
Yeah.
Coming from a totalitarian country, and I know that it was sort of toward the end of that regime when you were there. How do you compare the two? And what's your sense of this place where I'm guessing things are a little bit better than they may have been in 1985 when you were born in Cuba, but
yeah.
not today? I mean, what do you make of it?
Well, I like to say that I've spent most of my life in the United States, and I consider myself American at this point. But certainly, when I went to Cuba back on around my birthday, so right before Andrew and I got married, and it was interesting to see everything. I went to my old school. I went to my old house. I went to a bunch of places that I remembered. But it's different to see the country the way it is now because it's so much better than what I remember. It's certainly progressed forward, and I think the people of Cuba are trying to move on. I guess that's the best way to put it. And I wish the whole world would move along with them. but you know, here, America is such a great place. You know, you can do whatever you want. You can say whatever you want. You can be whatever you want. And I think right now we're losing some of that.
Yeah.
And I think we're losing our objectivity. We're losing our respect for each other. And that's, to me, is troublesome. And that's something that Cuba, unfortunately, went through a long time ago.
What is that experience, though, and even the difficulty in making the transition here, done for you personally in terms of your own, you know, resilience and ability to cope?
Yeah. You know, when you come from another place, you have to do a lot of adjusting. It's part of coming to another country. You have to speak another language. You have to get used to new food. You have to get used to cars. You have to get used to air conditioning, which thank you for air conditioning. You have to get used to a lot of things, but the important thing is that you just adjust or you don't adjust, you know? And some people do really well adjusting and some people don't.
But talk about now, and you mentioned it earlier, self-care, making adjustments in a career like yours where you're dealing with people who are, this is life and death for them. For us, it may be a matter of policy and headlines. But having to be removed back to a country where there was all of this violence.
Yeah.
Serious stuff. You're trying to help and you can't always. How do you manage to, you know, not be undone by that, by the stress that that causes?
Yeah. Sometimes you are undone by that, unfortunately. But my law partner, I think, has a good way of looking at it. And I've adopted her way of looking at it, which is when you're at work, you're at work. 100%. You know, when I'm at work, I give 110% to my clients, my staff, my law partners. We do everything possible to do the best job possible. And when I'm at home, I'm at home. That's sometimes it's hard to.
Well, I'm guessing your clients are trying to reach you all hours of the day, right?
Yes. And that's why I have two phones.
Both of them are in front of you now. And you're
yes, I'm looking at them right now. But I think that that's just a balancing act all lawyers have to do, you know, and learn where your boundaries are. And, you know, that's not easy for a lot of lawyers. Lawyers have a lot of issues with suicide, alcoholism, and a lot of organizations are really pushing for more secured leave for lawyers, which is just our ability to take vacation and let the court know we're going to take a vacation. More secured leave when there's maternity or there's a baby born, or you adopt a baby. Those kind of issues, I think, are important for lawyers to try to push, because as a profession, we can only help our clients so much. You know, we've got to also do a better job of taking care of ourselves.
Really great to talk to you, Anna Nunez, a partner at Fay and Grafton in Raleigh. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Frank. That was fun.
You can find out more about her work at our website, stateofthings.org. Coming up on the State of Things tomorrow, migrant workers in rural Jones County called 911 during Hurricane Florence. Nobody ever came. In fact, nobody told them there was an evacuation underway in their area. We'll talk to a BuzzFeed reporter that spoke with workers and the county's emergency management director about what was happening there. All of that on the State of Things, produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.